Paul's talking about a man called Epaphras who was always laboring fervently in prayers for the people in Colossae. Now, that's another interesting one. Would you say to somebody that you walked up to at study week and say, I'm laboring fervently for you in my prayers? What does that phrase mean? What is it telling us about prayer? What is it actually asking us to do? But it's this one that I really find interesting. This one when some of Jesus' disciples came to him and they said to Jesus, Lord, teach us to pray. Now, have you ever thought about that and just how unusual it was that they would come to Jesus and say those words? These guys had been praying to God since they were little. Israel had a strong background in religious worship, both in the home and in the community. And yet they come to Jesus, these men who had been praying all of their life, and they said to Jesus, Lord, teach us to pray, as John also taught his disciples. What these guys saw when they looked at Jesus, they saw a gap. They saw a big gulf between the way that Jesus prayed, the way that Jesus spoke to his Father, and the way they did. There was a difference in the prayers of Jesus to their comfort with their prayers. And the question for each of us tonight is, do you feel comfortable praying? Do I feel comfortable talking to God? Or do we feel like the disciples did in Luke 11 and asking this question, Lord, teach us to pray? Maybe some of you have only started praying recently. But there'll be many of you who won't be able to remember your first prayer. You will have said it with your parents when you were before memory time. Now, what are we going to do tonight? Tonight's not a full and detailed presentation on prayer. It's not a major 25-kilometre type service. It's really more of like a 5K checkup. It's just an opportunity for each of us to think about whether we're happy with where we're at with prayer. And what we're going to be looking at tonight is firstly some prayer roadblocks, and later on we'll be looking at some prayer tips. There's three common problems, I think, that many of us will be facing here tonight. Three common roadblocks in our prayers. The first is an eye problem. And you can see that I'm talking about the eye as in eye, not this kind of eye. There'll be some of you here tonight that are worried about what other people think, and you're probably here at Study Week doing lots to fit in and be accepted. And you're probably not just doing that here when you're together at study week, but in your everyday life, you're looking for acceptance. You're looking to not stand out too much from the crowd. You're worried about what other people think and say about you. And then there's the question, do you have relationship problems? Okay. And what does this have to do with prayer, relationship problems? Well, lots and lots, actually, and we'll come back to that a bit later on. Now, we're going to start by looking at a passage in Luke chapter 18. It's a parable that Jesus gave, and I really love this parable. It's a parable about a Pharisee and a tax collector. So somebody who is at the upper echelon of society, somebody who was respected and everyone thought was really great, and somebody right at the other end because they really hated tax collectors back then. And if anyone here works for the ATO, it's much, much worse being a tax collector in Jesus' time than it is now. So let's look at Luke chapter 18. I'm going to read these verses to you because obviously I can see and you can't. Jesus spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And here is this Pharisee with the eye problem. And what an incredible couple of verses there that talk about that Pharisee. This passage has more eyes in it than you'll find in an Apple store. It's good to say that to a young audience, because I said it once somewhere else and they just didn't get it. Somebody came up to me afterwards and said, I just can't get the connection with the apple. Is it something to do with the colour? I said, sorry. Sorry, no. Do you see the eyes all the way through there? I thank you, God. I am not like other men. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. I challenge you to find another way of putting another I into that sentence and have it still make sense. And there are probably some of us here tonight who know that we have an I problem. And it's good if we do know we've got an I problem, because then we can do something with it. It's more scary when we don't know that we have an eye problem. Everyone else around might know, but they even haven't told us, or if they have told us, we don't believe them. And what's so, I think, frightening about this parable is that the Pharisee thought he was okay. The Pharisee thought that he was doing everything right by God. And that is really scary, because we sitting here think that we're doing things right by God. And it worries me sometimes that maybe I've got it as wrong as this guy did back in Jesus' time. We have to decide in this parable who we're going to associate with, okay? A little survey, you know, I'm not going to ask you to put your hands up here because it might be a little bit embarrassing. But who do you associate with out of this that parable? If you had to pick one of those two, you know, who are you going to say you go with there? Who do you feel most at home with? That is a really hard question, a hard decision to actually choose from, isn't it? Would I go with the Pharisee? Do I feel superior to other people around me? And even if I don't feel superior to the people here at study week, do I feel superior to the people who don't believe in God at all, that I mix with at home? It's a challenge for us to think about. Do we ever feel like the Pharisee? Jesus was very clear that these Pharisees were doing things their own way. Okay, for those of you who are old enough to remember the Frank Sinatra song, the Pharisee could have listened to that every night. I did it. I'm not going to sing it, by the way. I did it my way. And we can do things our way rather than doing it God's way, which is what Jesus actually wanted them to do. It says that Jesus gave the parable for the Pharisee and not for the tax collector. Did that mean the tax collector was perfect before God? Did it mean that the tax collector was doing everything right in their life? that they needed to do? And the answer is absolutely not. But the tax collector knew that he had a way to go. He knew that he had to look deep inside himself and find something more to build and cultivate and encourage his relationship with God. The Pharisee didn't see it at all. There's another angle to this eye thing, you know, and that's about forgiveness, because the greatest inhibitor to forgiveness, I think, is being an eye person. It's very hard if you're an eye person to forgive somebody else when they do something to you. Much harder than if you're a more humble person. And we know that so many times Jesus said, you'll only be forgiven to the extent that you forgive others. In that model prayer that Jesus gave when the disciples said to him, Lord, teach us to pray, we all know the line. What is it? About forgiveness. Thank you. It's there, right in the middle. God wants us to forgive other people, and he'll forgive us as a result of that. And that's particularly hard for eye people to do. Now, what about being worried by what others think? Was this Pharisee worried about what other people thought? I guess a lot of what he was doing here was about showing other people just how good he actually was. And Jesus had spelt out the problem that people like this Pharisee had already in Matthew 6. When you pray, he said to them, you shall not be like the hypocrites. They love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. And the Pharisee was praying in a way that would make other people see him and be impressed by the sort of person he was before God and just how good a prayer he actually was. But if we want our prayers to be powerful, we have to stop worrying about what others think of us and start worrying about what God and Jesus think of us. Everybody who was looking at that Pharisee thought good things. Everybody, of course, but the people that were important, like God and Jesus. And there's a huge contrast. Have you ever seen the contrast between this guy and Hannah in the Old Testament? Hannah, Samuel's mum, who was praying earnestly to God. And if you don't know about that story, go away and have a look at it later on, because what did they think about Hannah when they saw her praying? They thought she was drunk. Very different, isn't it? They thought the Pharisee was doing a really good job, but he was totally unconnected with God. They thought Hannah was drunk. Was she connected with God? Absolutely. Her communication with God was effective and powerful. The greatest desire of her life was met because of that prayer. The prayer that she gave when people round her looking at her said, oh, she's drunk. We mustn't speak to this woman. But coming back to the Pharisee again for a moment, there's another interesting phrase in the passage which brings us to this relationship problem that the Pharisee had. I hope you picked it up as we read it. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. He wasn't communicating with God. There was no relationship going on here between Pharisee and God. The Pharisee was talking to himself. And some of you might have experienced a friendship where one person is just so consumed with themselves that they don't listen to you. It seems that they're not even aware of you. And sometimes we can be like this with God, can't we? Prayer will not work unless there is relationship there. And that is what I think fundamentally the disciples saw when they saw Jesus praying. They saw the evidence of the relationship that existed between Jesus and his Father. And that's what they wanted in their prayer. They wanted to feel the way that Jesus felt as he prayed. And what's our relationship like with God? If it's in trouble, we need to work at it. And sometimes that'll mean going back to square one and re-examining or perhaps even rebuilding our understanding of him. It's a really huge subject, but we need to sit down and think about what our image of God actually is, because it can affect our relationship with him and our prayer with him. I'll give you a couple of examples. Some of the ideas that people have about God make their ability to pray to him ineffective. Some people say that God is only interested in the big stuff. So people say there are certain things about us that God's really not too concerned about, that it's only the important things that we should take to him in prayer. Personally, I don't know where this idea ever came from, because I can't find it in the Bible. It seems to me that the people of God, with the best relationships, seem to tell God about everything. And I don't know how you feel when you read some of the Psalms, but when I read some of the Psalms, I think, my goodness, what they've said to God there, that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. That makes me cringe a bit, that they would say something so directly to God. I wouldn't be game to say that. I wouldn't say it to him. But these people did. And not only that, but God has made sure that those things are written down for us there in the Bible, so we can read them and we can see what was going on between these people and God. And they told God the things that were going on in the very depths of their hearts and minds. And he understood. Do you remember what David said when he laid out his credentials for going out in front of Goliath? He said, you know, I've been looking after sheep for a few years, you know. We got any farmers here? I've been looking after the sheep on the hillside. Okay, and sometimes wild animals come against them. And I've had to fight off lions and bears. And the difference between David and the other people, the other hordes of young Israelites who were sitting on mountains looking after sheep, because there would have been tens of thousands of them at the time, the difference between David and them was that David attributed his success in looking after those sheep and in taking his responsibility on the top of the mountain seriously, David attributed it to who? God. The Lord saved me from the paw of the lion and the bear. It was God that did it. And David in his life saw no difference between doing his normal, everyday working life job, even though his brothers thought it was pretty well beneath them. But David saw that as important to God, just as much as he saw it important to God that he would go out there and fight Goliath. And the reason he succeeded in fighting Goliath was because he had involved God in every aspect of his life up to that point, and he had a relationship with God, a real, real relationship with God. Was God interested in David's work on the mountain with the sheep? Absolutely. David knew it. And David knew too that God would be interested when he went out there to fight against Goliath as well. But in David's mind, there was little difference between those two events. They were part of his life living with God. Now, Jesus said something really interesting. Now, that, just in case you can't see it, is a hair. Jesus said, even the very hairs of your head are numbered. And this again is one of those phrases that you really want to think about a bit. Because why did Jesus pick the hair? Why didn't he say the ears or the eyes or the arms or the legs or the brain cells? Of all of the things on the body, he chose the hair. And do you know what? We can do without our hair. Lots of people do as they get older, if you hadn't noticed. Now, I've still got a reasonable amount. It's a different colour to what it used to be, you might like to know, and it's not the latest rinse. But many of my male friends, the guys I grew up with, don't have hair at all anymore. And even some of you approaching youth group old age here, you know, you've hit 25, have probably got friends you know who are thinning out already and have this little problem around here or around here or even perhaps around there where it's gradually getting a bit light on, you know. Jesus is making a huge point here. God is interested in everything about our lives. That's what he's saying by choosing the hair. Just like a good friend would be, or even more so than a good friend. And then perhaps I could take another example of some people who think that God is kind of distant and aloof and perhaps a bit stern, maybe like the aged uncle of our mum, someone we have to visit once a year and be on our best behaviour, and if we're really good while we're there, he might give us an old jelly bean that looks like he collected it 30 years ago. That's not a good image of God to have, you know, that kind of image. So some of us may need to rethink our image of God. And I've just chosen two things there. There's a raft of different ideas that people get in their head about what God is like. And some of those ideas are totally, totally wrong. And we need to examine what our image of God is, because until we get that image right, our relationship is going to suffer. It's a huge subject, but if that's your challenge, the thing that you need to face up to in your relationship with God, you might find some time this week to look at some of the passages about God and to build your own picture of a creator who is powerful, who is mighty, who has the massiveness of this universe under his control, but is also interested in each of us so much that he has 10,000 Cray supercomputers keeping track of the hair follicles of 7.2 billion people. I checked that this morning. It was 7245, and the other numbers kept changing so quickly I couldn't write them down fast enough. But there's that many people in the world, and he's got a lot of cloud storage too to keep the historical records of all those who have ever lived. That's the God that we need to understand. A God who, at one end of the spectrum, is about huge things and about mighty things, but a God, too, who knows every single detail about our lives, far more than our own parents do. Because whilst I've had a good mum and dad, I know very well that they never knew how many hairs I had. And God says he does, and I believe him. So let's think about those three common roadblocks to prayer, the I syndrome, the what others think, the peer pressure that all of us come in contact with and are pressured by in our lives, and the relationship that we have with God. And ask God to help you with those three things in your life. Because we can ask God to help us. I think one of the most powerful prayers in the Bible to me is the one that was given by the father of the boy that Jesus was about to heal. And this man said to Jesus, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." That is so profound, that phrase, isn't it? Because it is so often where we are. There's always that niggling doubt. There's always that worry in the back of our minds. There's always that latest challenge that we need to contend with. And God wants us to say those words to him. He wants us to be open with him like this man was and ask for help. Now, some prayer tips. A few things that I found helpful from the Word of God, and I really just picked some of them. Persistence, spontaneity. Now, you might be interested in what I mean by that one. We'll come back to that. Regularity, where, when and how, needs, not wants. And finally, faith, which is not so much a tip as something that sits as a framework around the whole thing. Now, what about persistence? Okay, Jesus wanted to encourage us to be persistent, so he gave an amazing parable about an unjust judge. It's actually in the same chapter of Luke as that parable about the Pharisee and the tax collector. And I'm going to read it to you. Jesus spoke a parable to them that men, and note these words, that men ought always to pray and not lose heart, saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, 'Get justice for me from my adversary.' And he would not for a while. But afterward he said within himself, 'Though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me.' Then the Lord said, 'Hear what the unjust judge said. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?'" And Jesus makes this comparison between God and an unjust judge. And I've heard lots of discussion about this. It's a good one for Bible class if it's a bit quiet. Some people are a bit uncomfortable about it. But if Jesus had used a good judge in the parable, we might kind of think to ourselves, well, the woman went to the good judge and she asked for something once, and when he said, "Well, no," she would say to herself, "Well, he's a just judge. He's made his decision. I better not ask again. If it really was the right thing, I should only ask once. And if no is the answer, that's the way it's meant to be." And most of us are used to parents who are always saying that to us. "You asked me that already, and I said no, and I'm not going to change my mind." What's really interesting is that Jesus is encouraging us to keep asking. He's encouraging us not to stop, but to continue. You see, with the unjust judge, the message is that the widow got what she wanted, not because of the justice angle, not even because of the rights or wrongs of it, but simply and only because of her persistence. That's the message of the parable. Be persistent. And if that's not an encouragement in our prayers, I don't know what is. If you believe, just keep praying. Don't give up. Continue. I like the way the message paraphrases the last verse of the section. But how much of that kind of persistent faith will the Son of Man find on the earth when he returns? And I think the message has grabbed the idea of what that verse is really about. Now, spontaneity. Why would I use the word spontaneity about prayers? I guess I use the word spontaneity is because there is nothing wrong with spontaneous prayers. And what I mean by spontaneous prayer is a prayer that we think about something on the spur of the moment, or something happens to us in our life and we pray straight away, there and then. And I'm sure you've heard the story of Nehemiah. That's, by the way, Nehemiah. You know, I have it on good authority. He looked exactly like that. And the king, you know, very, very bearded. But do you know the story of Nehemiah? It came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had never been sad in his presence before. And that was a big deal, to be sad in the presence of the king. You know, the king expected everything to be happy. And when you were sad, very poor development rating that year. But the king didn't worry too much about giving you feedback forms and loading it in the HR system. He simply said, take him out the back, get rid of him, I'll find another one. Now, I'd never been sad in his presence before. Therefore, the king said to me, why is your face sad since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. So I became dreadfully afraid. And said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favour in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. And of course, we know that the king did send Nehemiah. But that phrase there, I prayed to the God of heaven. Do you think Nehemiah said to the king, now, just hang on a sec, you've asked me a question, king. You just park that question for a moment. I'm just going over to the corner here and I'm giving a little prayer. And when I finish with the prayer, I shall come and answer your question. Do you think that's how it happened? No. I think we can safely infer that that's not what happened. When Nehemiah was faced with this important, this huge challenge in his life, he said a prayer that took simply a few seconds. I don't know what it was. Maybe God help me. Maybe give me strength. Maybe guide this situation. Something, but I guarantee it wasn't more than a few words. And there are so many times when we should think like Nehemiah. And when we're faced with a difficult situation and we're about to say something or do something, or we're really scared about what might happen in the next few minutes, that's when a spontaneous prayer is the way to go. A call for help to our loving Father. Let's not try and solve the problems and challenges of our life alone. And what this is really telling us, and what this idea of spontaneous prayer is about, is living in an attitude of prayer. And I really think that's what that phrase we started out with, pray without ceasing, is all about. Living with God there. Living and thinking about what God would want us to do here, or seeking his help. God is so different to the people that surrounds us in this world. Probably some of you are in jobs where the boss is always saying to you is, I don't want problems, I want solutions. Bring me the solution. But you know what? God is willing to take our problems. And not only that, but he's willing to work with us in solving and facing those problems, not just fobbing us off as we're so often fobbed off in the world. Now, how many people have seen the film The Fiddler on the Roof? Anybody? I was hoping, the old people in there? Okay, some of you have. What really struck me about that film is the way that the main character, anyone remember his name? Yeah. Oh, you have seen it. There you go. You remember his name. He continually communicated with God. Okay, now it particularly did suit a kind of dramatic presentation well, but I kind of liked the way that he kept talking to God about what was happening in his life. So it wasn't what we would call a formal prayer. He was simply running through in his mind all the pros and cons of the situation and kind of acting as if God was there listening to him. And do you know, I think that's what God wants us to do with him, to have that kind of relationship with him. If we acted as if God was there all the time, and he is, you know, we'd not have a problem with speaking to him here or there or anywhere. It'd be just like when we were sitting in the same room as a friend doing our own thing. And we suddenly think of something to share with them and we do it and then go back to what we were doing before. It should be no different with God. Now, regularity of prayer. Some people are very derogatory about habits. It's almost become a dirty word in our society today. But it's really interesting that science tells us that habits can be very beneficial to us. We can strengthen the pathways in our brains by exercising them. The more we exercise them, the easier it is for us to do something. And those of you who are into sport, I can't say those of us because I am not into sport, sorry. For those of us who are into sport, we know that that's true. But you know, it's also true about character and behaviour. And Daniel, that's Daniel. Of course, you recognised him straight away, didn't you? That's Daniel, who had established a very good habit in his prayer life. And it comes out in Daniel 6, when his peers, overcome by jealousy, were looking for something to pin on Daniel, and they couldn't find anything. Now, you know what politics is like today. I'm sure it happened there. They would have searched through all the old expense claims. They would have looked at all of the transactions that Daniel had been involved in or perhaps benefited from through all the years, the relationships he'd had with now undesirable characters, and they found nothing suspicious or inappropriate. Daniel had survived a number of regimes and he'd served in high office to the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians. He had survived major political change because of his integrity and his character. And all they could find to use against Daniel was that he prayed three times a day with the window open for all to see. It was his custom since early times. Now, I'm not really sure that people want... Would you ever do that to somebody, wander up to the window and stick your head in and look at them like that? I don't quite think it was like that. Perhaps it was more like this. But that's a bit starry, I suppose, that picture. And the hair's a little different too. Similar, but different. But this was Daniel. Daniel had established a habit, a pattern. Now, did that mean that Daniel thought that you couldn't pray to God at other times? Absolutely not. But he had made it a practice of his life to pray very regularly. And the really interesting question is the question that you have to answer. I'm not going to answer it for you. The question you have to answer is, did Daniel's habit of praying three times a day result from his relationship with God? Or was it the regularity of his prayer life that made his relationship with God? Now that is a really interesting question. So instead of thinking about what came first, the chicken or the egg, work on that one. Far more profitable, okay? And it's something for us to think about in our lives. Habits can be really good. A regular approach to prayer can help us a lot. And for some of you, you've probably not been through a really difficult time in your life when you really have to face up to some really challenging circumstance. Perhaps some of you have. And it's that habit, that regularity, that will help and nurture your relationship with God when life is really tough and we don't feel like praying at all. The habit will carry us through and bring us to a better place. Well, let's think about where, when, and how. Now, I don't have much time to spend on this tonight. I guess Daniel's habit of praying brings us to this idea. Daniel had decided to do it with the windows open so that everybody out there could see him. I think there was another reason why he did that, but you can come and ask me later about that if you're interested. Nehemiah prayed on the spur of the moment, though I'm sure he prayed at other times too. But we need to make prayer time in other contexts too in our life. Now, lots of people used to kneel when they prayed at home. I can remember my mum and dad doing it when I was very little. I think it's a lot less common now. Would that be true? A lot of people tend to pray when they're lying in bed, which is, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but sometimes you do fall asleep before you finish. Not a huge problem, but I suppose there's something about kneeling because it gives you a sense of humility. I'm only using this as an example. I'm not saying you have to go and do it, but you need to think through what might help you with your prayers. Some people feel closer to God when they're out with the nature. And if you're that sort of person, find a tree. Find a park bench. That wasn't meant to be funny. That was meant to be serious, you know. Okay, some people find that when they're sitting in a particular place with some particular aspect of nature around them, that makes them feel closer to God. If you're that sort of person, go for it. Find the place that helps you commune with God. But don't forget that above all else, God is everywhere. He's present in every circumstance and place in this world, and you can be surrounded by thousands of people in the busiest part of this world, and you can still talk to him. He is there. Now, one of the greatest challenges we face today is this one, need, not wants. And there's lots of wants there and one need, okay? And I think that's pretty true of my life and probably fairly true of yours too. We're so conditioned by our society to strive for our wants continually, aren't we? But we can con ourselves into believing that our wants are our needs and they are not. Now, I've got a few years on some of you, so I can give you a real example. When I was in youth group, about 10 years ago, I reckon. Oh, I feel offended. It's not that long. When I was in youth group age, if you were short of money, you cancelled your phone account and you used the public phone box. Okay, now probably some of you don't even know what a public phone box is, but they did used to exist. So you did that so you could actually eat. What's really interesting, I work for Optus, and a recent study that they presented to us at work shows that for your age group, and I'd be interested in finding out whether this is true or not, for your age group, if you're short of money, you'd rather go without food than cancel your phone account. And for a communications company, that's really positive. They're really excited about that because they got you. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's been a shift in society as to what people consider a want and what they consider a need. Okay? And you can see lots of examples of that if you look carefully around us. Now, I'm not saying that people were better than at sorting out their wants versus their needs when I was in youth group 10 years ago, because I don't think they were. It's something we all find incredibly difficult. But awareness of that problem is the first step. We need to consciously think, when we're asking God for something, whether it is a want or in fact a need. Now, faith. I said that faith really underpinned everything. And this passage is one of those passages that probably makes you feel a little uncomfortable. Because Jesus answered and said to the people around him at this time, have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will be done, he will have whatever he says. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them and you will have them. We need to have faith, that's saying. And have you ever thought about what that actually means to you and what that moving of the mountain into the sea is actually about? Jesus is making a very definitive statement there. You do need to go out and look at it, but it's really saying that faith is fundamentally important to everything. And we can be sure of one thing, that if we don't believe that God will answer our prayer, we will never receive what we ask for. We need to have real, legitimate faith. Now, a number of years ago, I was asked to give a prayer during a conference meeting. Someone was very ill and about to undergo quite severe treatment. And I gave the prayer. And after the meeting, someone came up to me and said, well, to be frank, they criticised my prayer. They thought my prayer was lacking in faith, that it was lacking in confidence in God. They said I left too many outs in my prayer. Have you ever been in that situation or thought about that situation? I thought a lot about it, both on that day and since. And I've thought about it a lot since. Perhaps it did seem as if I was lacking in faith. But I guess what I said first of all was, well, it's hard in the moment to always express exactly what we want to say. And initially I said to myself, well, I judged my prayer by the intent of my heart, okay? And I knew what was going on. I knew what I felt, basically. But everybody else who heard the prayer was judging it by the words I actually spoke. And I thought, well, perhaps, you know, I didn't put it as well as I could have, okay? And that was the difference. And it's an interesting thing to think about as a sideline, really, because we do need to remember that when we hear somebody else pray, we are just listening to their words. We're not seeing what's going on inside them. And there is always a gap between what you feel and how well you express it. Some people can express their ideas better than others. Some people find it really challenging. And we do need to be careful about jumping to conclusions about what people are and how they feel based on what they say. But that's a bit of a digression. Because I then got back to the point of saying, well, is that just me justifying myself? Or was that person's comment about me actually true? Did I believe that God could really save that person? Or had I sort of said to myself, well, it sounds a pretty serious problem. I don't think they're going to survive. Now, that's a question each of us needs to think about and to examine in our life and our relationship with God and in our prayer. Because there's kind of a bit of a line here. There's a bit of a spectrum. These are both Bible passages. One of them talks about whatever things you ask in prayer, believing you will receive. And it actually says you will receive, not you might receive. It says you will receive. And then there's that passage at the other end that talks about according to the will of God. So where are you on that spectrum? Because both those things need to be kept in balance. Where are you on that line? And I'd like in conclusion to come to Jesus for a moment and to think about him. It's where we started. Lord, teach us to pray, the disciples asked. And Jesus gave them the model prayer that we call the Lord's Prayer. And we didn't have time to go through that tonight, but it's well worthwhile spending some time perhaps taking that Lord's Prayer and translating it into words that you would use today. But considering examples of Jesus' prayer is also very important to us. There are a large number of references to Jesus praying, but we're not often given details of what he said. But the Garden of Gethsemane is one of the exceptions when Jesus prayed, "O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup be removed." It's an intensely personal prayer, and I think we're privileged to even have this piece of it recorded for us. There are two really interesting things there. One is that Jesus, when he was in Gethsemane, addressed God as "my Father." And it's the only time in the Gospels in which Jesus used the term "my Father" in a prayer instead of "our Father." There's also another very significant difference recorded about this prayer that's not there anywhere else in the Gospel. And that's that phrase that's been taken out of the original and just put into the English because the translators wanted to draw our attention to it. And that's that word, "Abba." "Abba, Father," Jesus said. "Everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." The only other two times in the Bible where that phrase, "Abba, Father," appears is used when Paul later on is talking about this event. And what's so important for us to see is that at the time of Jesus' greatest need and his greatest challenge, he saw the relationship with his Father as intensely, immensely personal and valuable to him. And he used that familiar name that people at the time, as very young children, called their dad. And the use of it tells us something important. The harder the decision we face, the more difficult the challenge that we bear in our life, the closer we need to feel to God. And Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane is also a model prayer for us. And Paul confirms that it's so when he refers to that model prayer with these words: "The Spirit you received does not make you slaves so that you live in fear again. Rather, the Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship, and by him we cry, Abba, Father." Do you notice it said "we," not "he"? Paul is saying that prayer of Jesus, that "Abba, Father" prayer, is a prayer for us too. And in Galatians, "Because you are his sons, God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, the Spirit who calls out, Abba, Father, my Father, Dad, Daddy." But back to Jesus' actual prayer. Was it the right prayer to pray? Some people have said that Jesus should not have prayed the prayer he prayed. Others have said that perhaps that prayer showed weakness. Jesus knew what God's will was, they say. And Jesus knew in the depths of himself that God would not grant his request. But his relationship with his Father was such that he could put it on the table and so can we. The mark of a true relationship, of a real friend, is the extent to which we can actually open up and tell the other person the innermost thoughts of our heart, our fears, our hopes, our desires, our dreams. And what this prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane shows, above all else, is a loving and caring relationship in which Jesus could express himself and his deepest feelings openly to his Father. Some of us may have had that kind of relationship with our human Father, but probably not that many of us. But what we can see is that God is the best Father we can imagine. There is no misunderstanding with him. He knows not only what we say or what we do, but the deep intents of our heart and mind. And in that he judges us by the intents of our hearts, the groanings that cannot be uttered. And the other important thing to recognise in Jesus is the absolute faith and confidence that he had in his Father. Surely there was an element there that said, Father, you are all powerful. You could find a way. And God could, but he didn't. Was Jesus' prayer answered? Well, Jesus, of course, had to go through what he really didn't want to. But the prayer did have an effect, a huge effect, because an angel came and ministered to him. God provided help for Jesus to do the right thing. He provided encouragement and strengthening for him in this hour of his greatest difficulty. And would the angel have turned up if Jesus had not bared his inner self, his innermost thoughts and feelings to God? If we don't ask for help, will God send it? There may be some of you stewing here tonight who are saying, well, what I've done or what someone has done to me, it's just all too bad. It's unforgivable. How can I pray to God? Well, I firmly believe that the only unforgivable sin is the sin that we don't want forgiveness for, or the sin that we believe that God cannot forgive. So if you are in that situation, please put this problem to God too. He will cleanse you. He will raise you up before him. He's done it before. You can find it in the Bible, and he'll do it again. Well, we have a little time now for you to meditate, to pray if you like, to build on your own relationship with God. No one else can do it for you. You've all had your copy of the 7 Minutes with God, and there's some really great stuff on this sheet that will help prompt your minds to build your own relationship with God. God bless every one of you this week. May he build your prayer to him into what it needs to be, what he wants it to be, enriching and powerful.